Today on the podcast, we have a very special guest. She's a retired senior foreign service officer, an international journalist. My mom, Cindy Biggs. Wow. Jeez. That was powerful.
So powerful. Yeah.
So what came up on that one?
Oh, man. Just so much love and gratitude that I'm not alone, you know, on this journey. That I have all these people that went before me that are rooting for me, that love me, that want the best for me, and that I can tap into that resource all the time, and I don't do it enough. I have tried to white knuckle it in the past and just thought that I had to be superwoman just out here conquering the world all by myself. And man, to know that that resource is there, it's always been there, it's just such an incredible gift. So thank you.
You're welcome. For those people that don't know, we usually start the podcast with a meditation that connects with the ancestors. You can connect first with your parents and then with many generations behind. So I think that's an emotional movement. Yeah.
Yes.
Jeez. So what comes up when you do that? I mean, is it connection? Is it some pain? Is it just pure connection?
It's pure connection. And I also saw, because my mother was a deeply religious, deeply spiritual person, she really set the example for me about the need to continue the spiritual quest. And I vividly remember her waking up every single, when I would get up, she would already have been up for a couple of hours, and she just poured her soul into the Bible. She was on a spiritual quest my entire life, and it really taught me such an important lesson that we just continue to seek. And so as she was coming up, then I also saw the series of really important spiritual mentors and therapists in my life that have just kept me on track and kept me going, and you know, a couple of occasions literally helped me save my life. Yeah.
So obviously for people listening to the podcast, you're my mom, just to create that context from the beginning. And you were the person that was first introduced to Family Constellations. Can you tell me a little bit about how that happened?
So, yes, indeed, I am the mother of John.
Not a little bit, a lot of bit.
And his sister, Alicia. And so all I ever really wanted to do when I was growing up, in addition to becoming, I wanted to be a spy. I wanted to become famous. I wanted to be an actress. And then I wanted to become a spy. But I really, really wanted to become a mom. And I had kind of a path laid out for my life, the way that I thought my life was supposed to go. My parents met in college. They got married between their junior and senior years because my father was a very, very insistent person. he liked to get things done. And I just kind of thought that's what would happen for me. I would meet my husband at college, probably.
Become a famous actress and a spy.
And a spy on the side.
Just my moonlighting cover, as a spy.
My cover would be the Hollywood gig.
Wow.
And, I mean, keep in mind, this was the 70s. I graduated in from college in 1979.
So was it like a funky spy kind of? Like bell bottoms and like international woman of mystery type of situation? That was the kind of spy that it was?
That was the kind of spy. Yeah. Yep. So I went off to college, and I fell in love with a wonderful man from Detroit, Michigan. And we were on the track to be married. And lo and behold, I had this class called Non-Western World. This was in Michigan, and everybody was required to take this class. And it was the springtime. And so I was a little bit more laid back. And a man walked into the room who I thought was British because he always carried an umbrella.
Oh.
And I can't even explain this instant zap that I felt. And so fast forward, to make a long story short, I ended my relationship with the other man, and your father and I began dating. And I always said, I really like this guy, but I am never leaving the United States. I was a television broadcast major, and I was going to move to Chicago. One of my closest friends was moving to Chicago, and my life was all set up. And part of my plan, no part of my plan, included leaving my country. And
wow, it didn't? Oh my gosh.
It also never included me learning to speak Spanish.
What other four languages?
My mother was a Spanish major in college. She and my father had a Spanish class together. And
Guillermo.
And she wanted all three of her daughters not only to go to the same college that we went to, or that they went to, but she also wanted all of us to learn Spanish. And, you know, I was so much smarter than my mother. I would put my hands on my hips and look at her and say, really, mother, I'm never going to use Spanish.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, boy, it could have helped me a lot in that first year when I moved to Venezuela. So we had a fascinating, wonderful life, two wonderful, incredible human beings along the way. We started out in rural Venezuela, moved to Mexico, moved to Brazil. We are pursuing my husband's career with a multinational company. And we finally got to headquarters, which happened to be a little town or city that was close to my little hometown in Michigan. And we kind of looked around and said, okay, we've got 2.2 kids, we've got, you know, a Dalmatian, you mow the lawn every Sunday, right? You play in the softball league. This is really not what we signed up for. And things went sideways for him, unfortunately, with the company he was working for. And so we moved back to Venezuela, where we lived for 9 years. I went back to working for ABC News. I'd worked for them in college. And
what was that like?
Working for them in college? Or going
no,
back?
Working for them and working for them in Venezuela.
It was amazing. It was fascinating. I still can't believe they hired me. They hired me. My colleagues at the television station encouraged me to interview with ABC of New York. And so we set up an interview in the Miami airport as we were moving back to Venezuela.
Are you serious?
Yeah, it was fascinating.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Jeez.
And I had some audition tapes. And so they hired me to...
Imagine a guy with like a recorder and you running down the airport and he's interviewing. You're like, I got to go to Venezuela.
There wasn't they didn't have budget to hire a correspondent, of course. So the arrangement was that anything that ABC did there, whether it was for Primetime Live, Good Morning America, ABC Radio, Nightly News, I would be able to help facilitate that segment being filmed, or I would do all sorts of things like help them set up a satellite feed for a president who was flying in from a neighboring country, because again, you know, technology was completely different back then. So
were you like the forward team, almost like the
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, like you were like the point of country point of contact.
Yes.
To make everything happen.
Yes, I was what is called a handler.
Oh,
until
that sounds very professional.
Doesn't it all? If you're in the industry, you're like the low man on the totem. Oh. You have to pick the producers up at the airport. You know, like set up all the pre-interviews and until President Hugo Chavez's attempted political coup. And I got a phone call.
In 1992?
We can fact check that. I can't quite remember.
Let's pull it up. Let's have the producer pull it up.
Where's your 10-year-old son
doing? Yeah, exactly.
It was 10 minutes to 12 at night, and my phone rang, and I got a call from this guy who was the foreign news editor in New York, and he said, "Hey, are you available? Can you cover the coup for us?" And I'm like, "Sure." And I'm like poking your dad.
Are you serious?
And they said, "Yeah, you're going to go national." So I am jumping up and down on the couch. You know, I get dressed. I'm jumping up and down the couch. I'm like, I'm going national. And I look over at my husband, my Venezuelan husband, and he's like shaking his head, you know, just, oh, my country. I'm like, oh, that's right. There's a coup underway.
Yikes. Yeah.
Yeah.
What a conflicting thing.
Oh, that was, yeah. But I had some incredibly interesting projects. One of the segments was for 2020. They devoted to the Miss Venezuela pageant, the phenomena that Venezuela had more beauty queens than any other country in the world, which was absolutely fat. I mean, it sounds very superficial, but the history behind it and the cultural identification that the Venezuelans had with this beauty, I mean, Venezuelan people are beautiful people, and I'm not just saying that because you're half Venezuelan, so. And so is your sister.
Yeah.
But there was a huge influx of immigrants before and after the war. And so they mixed with the Venezuelan people, the indigenous people, and the Africans who were brought to Venezuela. And it just made for these stunningly beautiful people. Your grandfather used to say that all Venezuelans are a mixture of coffee and milk. Some have more coffee, some have more milk.
Yeah.
And the result is just a stunningly natural beauty that may or may not have been tweaked just a little bit
enhanced.
The organization behind.
In the aftermarket.
That's right.
Aftermarket scene.
That's
yep,
right.
Yep,
yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, there's this theory of colonization that says that Latin America, because Catholic priests went in, that there was a lot more mixing of races.
Oh, wow.
Generationally, right? So over generations and generations, there wasn't this huge segmentation that happened in the U.S. So there was a lot just like this population that is, you know, you can have in the same family, people that are different skin tones.
Sure.
So it's like really interesting to, and then you produced incredibly good-looking people.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think back then, obviously, the political situation, Venezuela had the strongest democracy in 40 years. You know, they had the highest per capita consumption of Johnny Walker Black and the highest number of private planes per capita in the world. I mean, it was just there was definitely corruption, don't get me wrong. But they had elected a president who had served previously, Carlos Andrés Pérez. He was known to be corrupt, but I think the feeling was that he's so rich that maybe this time it'll be about power, not about wealth.
Yeah.
And he'll focus on doing good things for the country. And he, in fact, did. The middle class of Venezuela was growing. I mean, this predates the Chavez attempted coup. But it was a fascinating process to watch to unfold.
A lot of people don't understand this about Venezuela. It's like, you know, you hear it in the news a lot now. They're like, Venezuela is socialist, and socialist Venezuela. So, and it's like, it's deeper and more complex than that. Venezuela has always been center left, always.
Yeah, absolutely.
Universities were free.
Yeah,
there was private universities, but also very strong public universities. That you cannot become a doctor in Venezuela by paying money, right? So, doctors have this. I was talking about this in Dad's podcast, like how Doris, my stepmom, has such a social like debt because, you know, they have not a social debt, but like a social responsibility in some capacity that, you know, because in their education is completely free. And she spent time in the Amazon tending to, you know, local tribes and giving them medical care. And, you know, you can't, like, the scholarship that Dad got to study in the United States was government-sponsored. You know, the school system was completely free. There was a healthcare system that was completely free. The largest oil company in the world at that time was a public company. And so there was, like, everybody talks about, you know, not to say that socialism is good, but there is a version of strong social programs that work and worked for many years. So tell me a little bit about, you know, you were there during a very critical time and you were at the ground level of and met some really important people in the Venezuelan government. And you saw transformations. Tell me a little bit about that. Because it's always been socialist, right? It's been a little bit socialist, but something shifted.
Something shifted. So my marriage got a little crowded. Mm. I'm a former diplomat, after all. That's how I word it. And actually, my husband and his best friend suggested that I get a job at the U.S. Embassy. Because at that point, I did become a contributing correspondent for ABC during the coup because other news organizations were calling me up and ABC wanted exclusivity. And I said, well, because I just wanted the byline. I didn't care about money or benefits or anything. If you make me a contributing correspondent, then I will cover this exclusively, which I did, and some other fascinating stories. So I knew it, you know, the writing was on the wall that I was going to have to find a job that provided benefits and a stable salary, especially because there was concerns about currency exchanges being put in place, and we had a mortgage in U.S. dollars back in the States.
So this is 1999?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, exactly. So I applied for a job at the U.S. Embassy as a contracted employee, and I did that for 4 years. I covered the telecommunications sector, and at that point, Hugo Chavez had gone on to win with votes what he couldn't achieve with bullets.
Oh, that's yes.
Thank you.
Wow.
Thanks.
Man, you are a journalist.
So we were working closely with Hugo Chavez's administration. Let me backtrack a little bit. People wonder how in the world he got into power. And what happened was there was a U.S. election software and hardware company that had been working with the Venezuelan government to sell them their equipment. It was an ethical company. And in our position with the embassy, we facilitated the interconnection between that U.S. exporter and their partners on the ground, which in this case was the Venezuelan government, because that's what we did. We didn't make decisions. We didn't do deals. We simply put partnerships together. So that election, when President Chavez won, I believe the voter turnout was 35% of the population, even though voting in
35%,
and it's mandatory by law. It's not all countries require that you vote. It's not mandatory, but in Venezuela it is. If you don't, you don't get a little sticker on your national ID card, and so you can't avail yourself of a number of services if you didn't vote. But it had been a 40-year strong democracy, and even though Hugo Chavez never made any, there were no illusions that he was anything other than who he said he was, which he was proclaiming to be a socialist then. Some of the things he said were resonating with people because they were so tired of corruption and they were so tired of just a very small percentage of the population controlling all the wealth when the country has everything. I mean, absolutely everything. You throw seeds down in the soil in Venezuela and up sprouts anything, any kind of crop. You know, it's got oil resources. It's got natural gas. It's got hydroelectric power. It's got everything you could possibly imagine.
And the country's the size of Texas.
And the country. And it's physically the most beautiful country I've ever. The Amazon jungle, the flatlands, the Andes mountains. I mean, the islands. It's just stunningly beautiful. So the company sold the hardware and the software to the Venezuelan government. So that part was clean. 35% of the population turned out to vote. And almost, he came into power, and almost immediately the change started. We were trying everything that we could to support this democratically elected president, because he was. And the area that I intersected with them on was in telecommunications. So they wanted to, because, again, internet was a new thing.
What an interesting place to be at. What an interesting time. Because it's like the, like, really proliferation of the internet and this political movement that divides. So they kind of leverage this technology to expand their voice.
So there are some programs that the U.S. government offers to developing countries, which is what Venezuela was considered, obviously. And one of them was that if they were building out a sector, we would organize what's called an orientation visit to go to the United States so that the government officials could meet with their counterparts, the Venezuelan government officials could meet with the U.S. counterparts to figure out how you structure, for example, a telecommunications system. Because we were really they were starting from ground zero.
Like infrastructure. Like,
I don't know if you remember, but we lived in rural Venezuela, which we lived in a city called Maracay, which is an hour and a half west of Caracas. And we were there for 4 years, and we didn't have a landline. And there were no cell phones back then. And the waiting list to get a landline was 13 years.
13 years?
13 years.
Oh,
so if
my
I
gosh.
Wanted to call my parents back in Michigan, we would drive to Caracas, and I would go in your grandfather's office, and I would start dialing until I got an operator. And everybody knew I would be in there all day. And so I would just dial and dial and dial till I got an operator, and then the operator would patch me through, and then I would be able to talk to my parents. So the telecommunications industry was just in shambles.
I didn't know that. All day?
All day. All day long.
That must have been like torture.
And then sometimes they wouldn't be home.
Oh, God.
Then things got a little
bit
better.
That's like living on the moon.
Yeah.
That's like living on the moon.
Yeah.
Like you're like, hey, I'm going to send a message.
Yeah. Things got a little bit better. There was a public phone on our street, so you would just load up with tons of coins and then go stand in this horrendously long line to be able to call. That would sometimes work. Yeah, that coupled with the fact that, again, keep in mind, there was no internet, that
This was 1984.
Yeah, I mean, we moved to Venezuela in December of 1980. So from 80 for the next 4 years, we were living in Maracay. There was no mail service. There was absolutely no mail service. It just didn't work. You couldn't get a letter. You couldn't send one out. You couldn't get one back in. When my grandfather died, my neighbor across the hall had a phone. And somehow I had given that number to my parents, and they called my neighbor, and my neighbor came over and knocked on the door and told me that my grandfather had died. Anyway, all this backstory to say that the telecommunications network was a disaster. And so Hugo Chavez put in, it was the equivalent of the Federal Trade Communications. He started putting...
Which is Conatel, right?
Conatel,
yeah.
Exactly. He started putting some of his very, very trusted leaders into that organization, because for Chavez, the most important thing was loyalty. It was absolutely loyalty. So two of his most trusted advisors were put in charge of Conatel, and Chavez had heard about the importance, or maybe Conatel had, and I'm not going to name any names, they had heard about the importance of interconnectivity. And so the grand scheme was to put an internet kiosk on every corner so that people would have access to information. This was before they realized that information is power.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting once that happened, how they tried to dial that back really quickly.
So they were, the first thing was, so it seemed like they went in with the right intentions.
Absolutely they did.
They were like,
that's
we're
my belief.
Yeah. It could be, whether it's true or not, I mean, it could be, could be taken either way, but they did have the initial inclination or spark to say, we're going to connect every Venezuelan in some way with this new technology that's emerging so they can have power, or like knowledge at least, not necessarily power, but at least have knowledge. How did that transition, what did that look like when they were scaling it back?
So let me talk first about how they were scaling it up. So we set up this orientation visit, and we even got permission to put a telecommunications expert into Conatel, and she worked there for 1 year, and she had total access to everything.
An American
telecommunications expert.
Wow.
Who was helping build out, and yeah, we did a lot to help them build out their telecommunications infrastructure.
It really is.
I wish I could tell you the whole story.
Well, yeah, I know. There's much of the story that cannot be told, but yes.
So I really believe, and not just because I'm an optimist, because I'm very much my father's daughter, who was the most optimistic person I've ever met in my entire life. I really believe, and many people really believed, that the intention was good at the onset.
Yeah.
And I'll give you a very vivid example. On the first orientation visit, which was the first time these telecommunications officials had been to the United States, we set up, I can't remember, it was a week or 10 days, but not only were there meetings with their counterparts, but they were invited into the home of an American where we sat at this table and he talked about the importance of giving people the tools that they need to become empowered and how that helps grow a nation. And they'd never been in the home of an American in the United States, obviously, and much less having this absolutely fascinating conversation about what their position was going to allow them to do to grow their country, to continue on this path of having a strong democracy. So we did a couple of these, and I can't remember if it was two or three, but I distinctly remember looking over at this person that I was accompanying, and the Louis Vuitton extremely expensive leather suitcases suddenly showed up, and watches, and because power corrupts and money corrupts, and it was...
Do you think it's the power and the money, or do you think it's the layers of trauma and unresolved stuff that opens the gates to being corruptible?
Yes.
Or the us versus them, victim perpetrator dynamics.
Yes. Yeah.
Right? Because if you were presented with the option and had all the best intentions in the world and you saw what it could be and you chose to do it differently, to go down the path of re-traumatization, right? Because it's not like they didn't know what it could be like. What a solid infrastructure looks like, because they had been to the United States,
right?
You know, what the future could look like. It's not like they didn't know, but because of the rhetoric and the, you know, victimization and the stuff, we're able to justify another path.
Yeah. Well, and just going back for a moment about the milk and cream analogy that your grandfather used. In Venezuela, because of this mixture of races, you didn't ever really distinguish who was what race because it was just all a blend.
Yeah.
And I remember being so struck by the fact that racism seemingly didn't exist. I mean, it had to at some level, but I was talking to a colleague, and it dawned on me, he had blue eyes, dark skin, and it dawned on me, oh, wow, in the U.S., you would be considered black. Mm. It never even occurred to me that he was black before, never. And Venezuelans were always so shocked, as are many countries throughout the world, at the problems that we're still struggling with internally regarding racism. That was really interesting. And after Chavez was elected, all of a sudden, there seemed to be this divide that just kept growing and growing. And I remember once in the grocery store, the woman who was, because you had to get your cheese sliced at the deli. You couldn't just pick up sliced cheese. You had to ask for it, which was kind of wonderful because you would connect with a person and they would say, oh, you know, hi, little missus, do you want the same white cheese?
Yeah, give me a half kilo of
All of a sudden, there was this divide, and she was saying things to people on the other side of the counter like, I don't have to give you, you know, and it was like, whoa, where is this coming from? But I think you're bringing up this trauma that had always been there, that was underlying these people who lived in the poor sections of Venezuela, like the resentment they must have felt.
Yeah.
And while we're on the other side thinking, there's no racism here.
I think in Venezuela, it's more classism than racism. Like, that's the prevailing narrative.
Yeah.
Seems to be a class conversation. But, you know, I talk to this about to people a lot. It's like, you know, there used to be upward mobility in Venezuela because the infrastructure was there. And it wasn't, you know, obviously Venezuela would be a completely different country if the upward mobility was at scale. But you would hear stories of people that were from, you know, the interior of the country, a small rural town, studied, went to Caracas, the capital, went to university, became an engineer, and then worked for, you know, a large company. And then, you know, because there was so much opportunity in Venezuela that you would be like, I brought, I don't know, zippers from the United States, and you would sell all the zippers in the world and you'd become extraordinarily wealthy. So there was like these chaotic shoots of success that wasn't like systemic success. It was like individuals having success. And that further exacerbates the divide, right? And if you don't invest in the infrastructure to make more people have like a stable growth, then you have this divide or internal resentment that can be capitalized on by somebody of that nature. You know, people say that, you know, people are so interested in Trump. And I'm like, Chavez and Trump are very similar. They're divisive. They're very charismatic. You know, they're very funny. Like, Chavez was hilarious. He would talk for hours and he would be hilarious, obviously, you know, divisive and petty and all those things. But you would just see like this victim perpetrator narrative come up. So how was, once you identified that, what were the biggest changes that you saw in the society? Like, you're like, these people are becoming resentful, or everybody's kind of becoming resentful. What did you see?
If I can go back just a little bit to something that your grandfather always talked about, and that was that Venezuela, prior to the discovery of oil, was a completely different country. And that is, you know, you stick a spigot in the ground in Venezuela and out pops oil. Oh, yeah. It's such an oil-rich country. And I really think that was the biggest blessing and the biggest curse because it changed the mentality of the Venezuelans. Venezuelans were just really hardworking people, and they were all middle. Everybody was middle class.
Yeah.
There wasn't this huge divide. And then along comes the discovery of oil, and it literally changes Venezuela overnight. And it becomes that land of opportunity where you can sell zippers to everybody. And they invested heavily in education with that. Gran plan de
el gran mariscal de Ayacucho.
Exactly. Thank you. Just so many interesting dynamics in a pretty young country taking place. So the administration, Chavez administration, gets into power. The money is there. I think all these people who have never had money before, have never had access to wealth and power coupled with their trauma, they get into these positions, and it just takes a few bad apples to start changing the mentality. And you're the head of administration of, you're in the Ministry of Transportation, and the minister over there is getting real rich. Look at the car that they just drove up, and and it just pretty quickly changed the face of the country. And Venezuela started identifying with other countries who also, their people had experienced trauma. So they were doing trauma bonding with these countries that were being led by people who had a kind of ideology where at some point, maybe they did want to change the country for the good. Their intention was good, but they got into those positions. And there's something to be said about wisdom and experience. And you don't nosedive, you don't parachute into the position of being president of a country without having any prior experience about how governments work.
Yeah.
It's really important. And I'm not saying that it's the only requisite. I'm just saying there's a learning curve there.
Yeah.
And in the beginning of that learning curve, if you see all these problems and all this money, and you're being contacted by these other colleagues of yours in other countries, and they're saying, this is how we do it, and your influences, your ideology was maybe tilting, the relationship between Cuba and Venezuela has always been really strong.
But what's happened? So the KGB was recruiting out of La Universidad Central de Venezuela, which is the central university of Venezuela, since the 60s, since the 50s. Carlos the Jackal, all those guys were, there was deep-seated, already those seeds, deep-seated seeds, that's not the right phrase, but like they already planted those seeds of that ideology, or that I just think it's a victim perpetrator dynamic. It's like that if you don't have something, somebody else is taking it away from you. And it's not, it's the systemic divide of power and those that are power, the oppressed, the oligarchs. Like you started hearing that language in Venezuela, and those seeds were planted. The professors of those guys that went to military universities and were people that were indoctrinated in some way by Marxist ideology, and it's really interesting to see when it exploded, which really exploded in the 2000s.
So, just kind of a very visual example of that changes. There's a big park in Caracas, and we were training for a marathon, and so we would have to go, we would always go to this park and run and run and run. And all of a sudden, after Chavez was elected, you would see groups of young people sitting on the grass, and these guys wearing white shirts, white t-shirts, and red bandana, or red berets, which was the symbol of Chavez, of being a Chavista. That was the uniform that you wore. They were indoctrinating these young people. And every week, there would be more and more of these small groups. And in the backdrop is a private, it was a private airport called La Carlota. It's a private
military
airport. Yeah. You would see planes landing. And the planes were full of Cubans coming in. And so when the unrest started, I think it probably was difficult to convince the Venezuelans to carry out these intimidation techniques. There was a campaign of intimidation. One of your sister's friends, their younger brother was out playing basketball and just in the building. And he was picked up and taken away and thrown into the back of a truck with a whole bunch of other young people. Just to threaten, he was returned or released or whatever, but they were just campaign. It was a technique of planting the seeds of this is what happens if you speak out. And then to come full circle, Chavez realized, oh gosh, information is freedom. And he brought in a speaker from Cuba to go to the Simón Bolívar University. And the speaker was talking about one of Chávez's campaign tactics, I can't remember, or one of his promises. And he was booed out of the stadium. And then very, very quickly, access to internet started getting shut down.
Oh.
Because they realized, oops.
Yikes.
This is going to work against us.
It's so interesting to see that we have a blueprint that's culturally similar, right, to how this works.
Yeah.
Like it, and you know, there's such a red herring around Venezuela. They're like, you know, you hear it on like Fox News or whatever. It's like Venezuela, blah blah blah, and you, in like those 3 or 5 second sound bites, they're like Venezuela is crap. He's like, hey, we're all going to end up like Venezuela. It's like, dude, Venezuela's a case study for understanding what unresolved trauma does and how that can be leveraged for power to destroy a country that was once on a really great path.
And it's also a case study for the importance of taking care of your democracy.
Yeah.
Because if you don't turn out and vote, you get what you get.
Yeah.
And it, even though it was 40 years strong, it can turn overnight.
Man.
So that's a very, very long-winded answer to your question.
I mean, this is the tangent of this is how this works.
So things were not looking good in Venezuela, to say the least. And things were not looking good for the future of my marriage. So I took the test to become a foreign commercial service officer, and I passed. And my son, you, my daughter, and I left Venezuela to go to my first assignment in Monterrey, Mexico, where I served at the consulate.
Shout out to Monterrey, Mexico.
It kind of changed the trajectory of your life, because that's where you discovered that you were going to make a very profound decision to join the U.S. Air Force.
Yep.
Am I allowed to ask you questions?
Yeah, sure.
Can you tell me about...
I mean, it's an open format. There's no rules. Yeah, of course you can ask me questions.
So tell me about how that decision felt to you when you were making it, and how, now that you look back, how it helped shape your life.
I took an aptitude test when I was in high school, the rare times that I was there, and it said I should have joined the military. Yeah, and I always thought the Coast Guard. Like, I was like, I'm going to join the Coast Guard. I don't know why. It seemed cool. It seemed more technical. You know, the Coast Guard seemed very technical, like they were doing technical water operations kind of thing. And I was like, I'm going to, you know, that was a thing. But then I moved to Monterey, and my best friend was going to school at UF. And he was like, dude, come to UF. And I was like, deep down inside, I was partying so much in Mexico and just doing God knows what. And if I would have gone to UF, I would have lost the plot, you know. So deep down, as my cousin had just joined the Navy, and we literally went to McAllen, Texas, and walked into the recruiting office for the Navy, and it was full, and the Air Force was empty, and the Air Force office was completely empty, and I was like, I'll just join the Air Force. So it was. I knew deep down inside that it was going to be part of my story, but the decision wasn't a decision that was made. It was made more out of curiosity, which is how I make most of my decisions. Just kind of like, oh, you know, kind of bumping into things, and I'm like, oh, this was cool, and then took the test and joined, and you know, I knew looking back on it, it was the best decision that I could ever made. They gave me a ton of responsibility at a really young age, and gave me the parental structure that I needed, that I didn't have, you know, because of the chaos of growing up. And, you know, I got a ton of responsibility and made great friends, and it was the best, you know, the best decision I could have made. And leaving the military also was one of the best decisions I ever made. It was really tough, but 8 years, you know, was a great run, and I'm, you know, very proud to be a veteran. So yeah, looking back on it, it's one of the best decisions I ever made, and it gave me some infrastructure and some tools that I'll use for the rest of my life. Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah.
Monterey was an important place for
a lot of us. I remember, and I'll probably get emotional about this, but I just remember how welcoming Mexicans were for me. You know, they were just great people. You know, I still have lifelong friends that are there. So, yeah, it was a tumultuous time for me, but it was a very formative time for me. Like, I got accepted into this group of friends that were just incredible people. And they're still friends of mine today, and they're still very close-knit. And it's very rare for that group or that society in Mexico to accept foreigners, you know? And I felt very honored to be part of that group in some capacity. So, yeah.
And I wonder to what extent the fact that you had lived there in your formative, I mean, you lived there, we moved there in 1984, 1985, and you lived there for a couple of years. I wonder if everything felt from it, even though the culture in Monterey is quite distinct from where we lived in Querétaro.
Man, I remember flying into Monterey and everything's so sandy. Do you remember that? It was like so arid because we were in Caracas, and Caracas is one of the greenest cities in the world. Beautiful tropical, you know, forest.
City of eternal spring.
Yeah, exactly. And then we were flying into Monterey. I was like, wow, this is so different. I remember it being so bright. Yeah, I remember it being so bright. And that was interesting. Yeah. Okay, so Monterey.
So from Monterey, I was assigned to Bucharest, Romania. From Monterey, I started dating this guy online, and he was just had the most beautiful heart of anybody I'd ever met in my life. He was just a person that you never walked away from him without feeling better, just better about life. He was the pastor's son, not the first pastor's son I've dated. Dated a few, actually. he was just an incredible human being. And we had dated, you know, it was an online, I mean, a long-distance relationship, but he had been to Monterey. And so I was sent to Washington, D.C. to study Romanian because that was my assignment. And he lived in Baltimore, and so our relationship just got deeper and deeper. And then when I moved to Romania, your sister came with us, came with me, and you were back in at that point you were in England.
I was stationed in England, yeah. Right?
Which was great because we were all going to be in Europe.
Yeah.
It was wonderful, actually. Yeah. It worked out really well. And I was profoundly in love with this man, profoundly. And, things were a little messy with his former life, and he was cleaning that up, and we had kind of talked about our future. I was convinced that we were going to be married. And so he came to visit me in November in Bucharest. And this was 18 years ago. And
this was 18 years
yes,
ago.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
And I was going to be, for Christmas that year, I was going to be by myself. And what was great about him visiting me was that he met everybody that I worked with, and everybody just fell in love with him. And he saw where I lived, and we just had a magical time. I remember I was very emotional during that when he was there. I was just very, very emotional, and I couldn't quite understand what was going on. But he said goodbye and flew back. And then that Christmas, I was going to be by myself for the first time since your dad and I had gotten divorced. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of scared. And my parents, lo and behold, saw that. And even though my father had Parkinson's at that time with early stages of Alzheimer's, they showed up.
Yeah.
They upped his meds, and my father was on track. It was the most beautiful Christmas gift I could have ever gotten in my life. We just had such an amazing time. And on December 27th, I went to work. My parents were still at home. And I went to work, and I got a phone call from my boyfriend. And He was in a country in Africa where he had gone to visit his daughter who was working as a volunteer. She's an incredible human being. He has four kids, and they're all incredible human beings who are making the world a better place. So he was visiting her, and his crown had fallen off. And I kept saying the prince needed a new crown. So he was in the capital city of this African country and called me and, hey, I'm here with my daughter. My crown fell off and we're going to head off to this refugee camp where she worked as a volunteer. And so I said, as I always did, okay, great, blah, blah, blah. I remember telling him how wonderful he was. It was just like, and I had done it before because I just couldn't get over the fact how wonderful he was. And I was just saying, you know, blah, 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 blah. And then at the end of the conversation, I said, I love you. And he missed a beat because his daughter was sitting right there and he was always very respectful of that. And he said, I love you too. And he hung up. And I went home and 90 minutes later, I got a phone call from his mom and she said, we just got a phone call from the country he was visiting, and they think he's dead. Oh. And I said, oh, yeah, I just talked to him 90 minutes ago. Don't worry. There's some confusion. She said there was a body with lying next to the car that the Jeep he had rented. I'm like, don't worry about it. I got this. I'm going to make some phone calls to my counterparts in that country. He's not dead.
Oh.
And lo and behold, he was. And it sent me into a tailspin. My divorce, because it was the end of a dream and something that was unacceptable in my family. You don't get divorced. No matter what, you stick it out. That was really, 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 really hard. This was pain on a different level that I never felt because I'd never lost anybody before, and certainly not lost anybody suddenly. And you know, there's all sorts of different kinds of grief, and the sudden loss of someone is a completely different level. I remember I was pacing the floor in the living room, and my father. And then I finally just kind of collapsed on the couch, and I was holding my head in my hands, and I'm going, no, 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 no. And my father was standing over me, and he's saying, Sin, don't worry. It's not him. It's not him. This is somebody. And my mother, who had lost her only brother in a sudden car accident, same type of head injury, they also believed that he was okay, which is what happened to my boyfriend at the time. They thought he was okay. And he waved his daughter on because she had broken her leg, and he said, don't worry, you go ahead. And then he died. The exact same thing had happened to my mother's younger brother, had a head injury, went to the hospital. The hospital sent my grandparents home, and he died. Ding, ding, ding.
Yeah, right? Jeez.
Yeah. So I remember my mom in the background pacing back and forth, and she knew. She absolutely knew. I didn't know what to do. So I went to bed. Everything on me hurt. My hair hurt. I did not know what I was in. My body physically was in so much pain, which I think is the embedded trauma. I was reliving everything that my mother had relived because I had inherited that trauma in my genes, in my DNA. And this is going to sound strange, but I'm going to say it anyway because this is who I am. I remember all of a sudden, it was like a gold spun blanket came up from the foot of the bed and slowly covered my entire body until it got up to my neck. And I said out loud, Tom?
Wow.
And I went to sleep. And I slept deeply. Your sister had sort of been in denial about the divorce, and you had been a bit more vocal in your pain, and she hadn't, which is sort of true to your characters.
Yeah.
She's since learned tools to utilize. And So we were in Bucharest. I was a hot mess. And she was walking down the street in front of me. And she stopped and she turned around. She had big crocodile tears running down her face. And I said, "Are you ready?" And she said, "Yes." She was ready for therapy. I'm like, "Okay, clearly I need it." So I had started with a therapist before this, my boyfriend died, and she was in therapy. I was in therapy. And as soon as my boyfriend died, I hadn't been in that many sessions with this therapist of mine. And I called him up and I said, "This happened." And he said, "How soon can you get here?" And I said, I can't even move. And he said, "How soon can you get here? Come now." And I got in the car and I drove there. I don't know how. And he said, "That's when I knew you were going to be okay, because you came." So he said to me, there's this kind of therapy that we're going to be doing in the mountains, the Carpathian Mountains, this summer. And it lasts 10 days. And I think it's going to help you. And I was in such a bad state that if he had said to me, "Light your hair on fire and run down the street naked," anything, I would have done literally anything to feel better, because I didn't know what to do with this massive grief that I felt. And so that summer I went, and I hadn't done any research on this, on what I was going to be doing. I just showed up. And So he died in December, and this was in July. So I show up, and there are 33 Romanians. I was the only American. They had brought in a facilitator from Spain who, I walked in this very large room, and I saw him at the back of the room. And I remember looking up through this haze of pain that I was in, and I saw him, and there was just instant recognition. There was just an instant, he saw me, I saw him, and that was it. It was just a fleeting moment. And then he proceeded to teach this group of people how to become facilitators in the kind of therapy that he was going to be instructing on, and the therapy which ultimately truly saved my life. And of the group, I believe there were 33 of us, and 3 of us were not therapists.
Wow.
So if you believe in a knowing field of consciousness, if you believe in energy, if you believe in quantum physics, if you believe in what you put out, you get back. The level of consciousness in that room, as well as the level of trauma, was just incredible. Because quite often, therapists in their past are trying to heal themselves, and they're drawn to that kind of a career because they want the answers. My mother would have been an incredible psychologist. Yeah. She would have been incredible architect. She would have been an incredible CEO. She was a very, very gifted, very, very smart woman. So those 10 days, it was as if we lived in this bubble. And I became aware of how intertwined my trauma was with my mother's. So we did a constellation. When it was my turn to do a constellation, the facilitator invited me to come and sit next to him
in the hot seat.
And at the beginning, you know, I'm looking at this process and I'm thinking they're all actors. And I couldn't, you know, I didn't believe that there was any way that I could have somehow mysteriously transmitted my truth to these people. And until the facilitator invited me to represent someone who was in the hot seat, and I felt this strange energy And not very many words were spoken, but as the facilitator instructed me, if you cannot resist the urge to go right, to walk to your right within the confines of the circle, and all the other people present are sitting around you, if you cannot resist that urge, go right.
So can I set the stage a little bit?
Please.
So it's a ballroom.
Yes.
Right? And it's basically an open floor space, and there's 33 people sitting in a very, very large circle sitting next to each other. And at the, you know, at one end is the facilitator with an open chair, and you're sitting in that chair in this circle, and that circle is called the knowing field. And some like that's the terminology that they use, is that this is the knowing field.
Yes, thank you.
No, just some people don't know what family constellations are. And, yeah.
So when it was my turn to have my constellation done, the number of representatives that had to be pulled in to the knowing field, to the circle, was incredible. I think almost every single person in the room was part of my constellation. It was just a huge, huge, huge circle of people that were there supporting me and the information that I was transmitting to them with very, very few words. And the reason, and I don't know how much you've gone into this in past interviews you've done, but we are so loyal to our systems that we literally can't see patterns, and we can't see loyalties that are deeply embedded in our subconscious mind that drive us to make choices and to act out things that aren't necessarily in correlation with our values or who we are. You know, sometimes you look at families and the same parents raise three children, and one child is completely opposite from another child, and you think they were raised in the same environment. How can that happen? And quite often the explanation are these loyalties. They're adopting something which doesn't belong to them.
Yeah.
So I had adopted many things that didn't belong to me. And in subsequent constellations that I've participated in, I've come to know the truth, and that is, our loyalties are so deep, we will violate ourselves at any cost. We will die. Some people die out of loyalty to those systems that we're not even conscious of. And so what a constellation does is, when it's your turn to do to have the constellation done for you, you select people in that group to represent you, or to represent usually your family of origin. You always come in thinking, oh, I'm going to do a constellation about, you know, my boyfriend or my problem at work. It usually always starts with your family of origin. But you could never act out as your mother. You could never represent your mother or your father or even you in that circumstance because of these loyalties. But the people who are representing your family or you, they don't know anything about you.
It's like the same, it's like you lose the forest for the trees.
Yeah.
Like,
you can't see the forest for the
trees. Yeah, you can't see the forest for the trees. And, or it's like when somebody that's really close to you says something, like your spouse says something to you, and you're like, you're crazy. And then a friend that's outside of the system says something, and you're like, absolutely, I've been doing that. It's like a similar energy to that, right?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And it's something that needs to be experienced.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, as Sophie.
Yeah.
It needs to be experienced, because as I'm sitting here talking about it, it just sounds like weirdo voodoo, you know, craziness, right? And that's what I thought when I first saw these people laying on the floor in front of me, and I see the facilitator in the background 18 years ago, and I'm like, what the heck is this? Until I'm in that seat and I'm seeing all of these things coming together. Okay. So the person representing my mother is looking down at a person who's representing her brother on the ground. The person representing my mother doesn't know what happened to my mother. The person on the ground doesn't know what happened to her brother. And the person on the ground representing her brother says to the facilitator, I feel like I'm two people.
Wow.
He was representing my mother's only brother, and he was representing my boyfriend who had been killed in an accident of a head injury.
Wow.
So I'm happy to say I've done many, many, many constellations throughout the years and with different facilitators. And I'm happy to report now, 18 years later, there's a lot less people in that circle representing my ancestors.
Yeah.
But it never stops. And I just did a constellation this past summer. I mean, not this fall, in Chicago. And so that facilitator has everyone who is present put their name in a hat. If they want, no, even if they don't want to participate, if they're there, their name is going into a hat. And then the people who are going to do a constellation, a paper is selected and your name is read and you're going to do a constellation. And I've said in the past, I'm not going to do one. You know, I'm just here to support the others. And the facilitator is like, no, if you're here, your name is going in the hat, because if you're supposed to do a constellation, you need to have your name in the hat and it's going to be drawn. And lo and behold, I was convinced, and I'm like, I don't really have anything to work on because, jeez, you know, I'm quote unquote healed.
Yep. Yeah, we're also healed.
Joke's on me, because that constellation turned out to be the beginning of something so incredibly profound, a theme in our family dynamic that was so incredibly profound that it needed to be brought out to the light. And it was. And for me, it started me on a path to healing and wholeness that I literally didn't know existed. I didn't know I had suppressed this part of me so deeply out of loyalty that I couldn't see it.
Yeah, and there's a book called Even if it cost me my life, the force of loyalty. I truly believe that the force of loyalty is the strongest force in human connection. But so with that said, you know, this isn't the only type of therapy that you've done. You've done many modalities of therapy. Can you go through kind of the ones that you have done? And
yeah. So I actually wanted to major in psychology, and I think my father wasn't the first time told me, no, you will not. I wanted to major in social work. No, you will not. I also wanted to quit college and go to Hollywood because, again, I wanted to be an actor, and he said, no, you will not. So when I was in college, I took some psychology class. I was just intrigued with the topic, and I would volunteer for any time they needed people to come. The psych department needed people to come in. And sometimes, I remember one time I had to go into a booth with a camera pointed at my eyes, and then talk about a subject that was heavy on my heart, and I think it was my relationship with my father. And they would just record my eyes. So that's really the first time I started delving into psychology. And then little bit of therapy around our divorce, but not very much. And to be honest, the only reason I asked your father to go to this therapist with me was because I knew the therapist was going to convince him that he was in love with me and he could never leave me. I knew it.
It's a solid strategy.
And then I didn't do therapy for a while until my boyfriend died. And then I got into it in a deep way. I did therapy when I was in Calgary, Canada. My youngest sister, who was 18 months younger than I am, died a very quick death. It was a long, slow 4 months from diagnosis to death. Four months transpired. And I literally felt like someone had removed a third of my body. Mm. And, you know, I remember thinking, I can't do this. Like, there's no way. Because really, if you had asked me, tell me the worst thing that could happen to you, that there's no way you could survive. There's three things, and in not this order, but one of them would have been the death of one of my sisters. Because as my sister has famously said, my older sister, Sue, we were like a three-legged stool. And wow, you literally ripped one of those legs off, and both of us wobbled for years.
Yeah.
For years. So this therapist, who is just an amazing human being, she really, really saved me. She absolutely saved me from what I thought was going to be the end of me. I knew I would never take my own life. I always knew that, because I would never do that, because you two are the most important things and always have been in my life. But I just didn't know how I was going to live.
But we all know that there's other ways of doing that.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
There's other ways of doing that. And that's the tough part, is that you might not, you know, physically do it, but there might be a disease that happens or something that happens, and then within a short period of time, you're gone.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I got therapy when I was in Washington, D.C. I found a therapist because Polish is a really, really, really hard language to learn. And I started learning it in person. I was assigned to work at the embassy in Warsaw, Poland. A lot of people don't like to go to that post because the language is so hard.
Are you serious?
And language learning, I've discovered, does not get easier with age. So it was my full-time job. So the U.S. government does an amazing job of training its foreign service officers to be able to engage in the language of their host nation. It's one of the things we're known for, and it makes so much sense, and it puts us in a very different position when we're engaging with host governments, because it's not just that you can converse with them. Let's be honest, most government officials speak English. Certainly in the developed markets where the federal agency that I worked for are in. But the fact that you took the time and the government provided resources for you to understand their language, is it just, you walk in, even if you just say a few words, and it also helps you understand the culture.
Yeah.
How can you live, thrive, and strengthen ties, in my case, commercial ties, between the United States and the country I'm serving in, if I don't even speak the language?
And if you don't have cultural context, it'll be impossible to connect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lots of U.S. companies blunder big time.
Oh, I would imagine.
Just because of that. They don't understand the culture of the country that they're doing business, they're trying to do business in. So I was, COVID broke out, and I was relegated to a very, very small apartment in Arlington, Virginia, and doing online courses. And
a very challenging teacher.
Yeah. The world shut down, and I was by myself in this very small apartment. And remember when COVID first started, and you would go to the grocery store, you know, mask up, get gloves, swab the shopping cart down, and they had arrows on the ground so that you wouldn't, you know, come face to face with another shopper. And when you would turn the corner and there a shopper would be,
terror.
Exactly. Of, you would rush home and wipe your groceries down. And I mean, it was terrifying because we didn't know. Nobody knew. We'd never lived through this before. And to say that that was challenging for me would be an understatement. I am a total extrovert. I live off connecting with people, and I was desperately, desperately lonely. My partner slash boyfriend, we would talk on the phone a few times a day, but he was living in another country and I couldn't see him. I couldn't see you and your sister. I couldn't see my sister. I couldn't see anybody. There was just no chance for interacting with people. And I was, and it's interesting because I have all these tools. I really do have knowledge of a lot of tools. So I was doing everything that I knew I needed to do. I was getting a lot of sleep. I was eating really healthy. Went to the grocery store every single day. I was meditating, and I either walked or ran every single day along the river. I got outside every single day. And even with all of that, I was struggling. I was really struggling. I felt lonelier than I've ever felt in my entire life. And so I found a therapist, and we did online until things started opening up a little bit more, and we could at the end start meeting in person. And that was extremely helpful. And I guess I'm underscoring the importance of what I went through during COVID, because I think part of what we're seeing play out now on the streets with the increased violence, it's just, it feels sometimes like the world is on fire. And I think that if people went into COVID kind of teetering and they didn't have the tools they needed, COVID sent a lot of people over the edge. Yeah. People died. So many people died. They lost their loved ones, and they couldn't say goodbye to them in their final moments.
Yeah, it's like a forced sadness. Oh. It's like a forced tragedy. It's so.
I mean, we've lived through some of the most honoring, respectful, beautiful experiences in saying goodbye to our loved ones that you could have. I simply can't fathom if my sister had died during COVID and we couldn't usher her out of the world in the way that we did. I can't imagine the level of pain that I would have right now. So, and lost jobs, lost incomes, people lost their homes. You know,
Businesses.
Yeah. I mean, it changed the world. It was a huge paradigm shift. There are many gifts in it. There are many, many gifts in COVID, but we're not addressing the trauma that caused. It's just like, okay, whoop, we're back, and we're back to the office, and, oh, you don't have childcare? Okay, we'll figure it out, and get back to the office. Yeah. Not the Department of Commerce. Our Secretary of Commerce is addressing that, the importance of having on-site childcare.
So you know what's really interesting? They talk, so Gabor Mate talks about this, talks about not everybody, you know, so not every soldier that goes to war comes back with PTSD.
Yes.
So there's a percentage of soldiers that come back with PTSD, and they usually have unresolved childhood trauma. And so what I think with adverse events that are later in your life are re-traumatization events that happen. So if you're, you know, if you're in that place, and there's so many people out there that have unresolved trauma that gets exacerbated during adverse events, and that's like such a thing that we don't talk about. Everybody says it's like it's COVID's fault. It's like, well, that's not really COVID's fault. Life's going to happen. You're going to have something that unexpectedly happens, and if that core childhood, you know, the ACE thing, you know, the adverse childhood experience gets re-triggered, you're going to be in a really bad place. And so it's like kind of understanding those dynamics and understanding that at scale, that we really have to have a national conversation about that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of a case study or the poster child for that, because I was seemingly, you know, this person, I function, I'm pretty high functioning, and I'd made it through life
very
until
successful, you know.
I had a divorce, And I spiraled down.
Yeah.
I lost this man with whom I was deeply in love, and I spiraled down. I lost my sister, and I spiraled down.
Yeah.
And those are like the big three that I can think of, but I've had lots of other stuff. And if I didn't have access to the tools that I do, if these people, because I really am, I'm a deep believer in God, and I deeply believe that God doesn't cause bad things to happen, but God will use those things to help you become who you are meant to be and to help you heal. And I would never say, gosh, I wish that was so great I got divorced. I'm so glad my boyfriend died. So glad my younger sister died. But oh my gosh, I'm so incredibly grateful that I got to have those experiences with the help of people who were placed in my path who would show me, this is the lesson that you can learn from this.
Yeah.
We all have adversity. Everybody has adversity. And it's just what we do with it. We know some people, something tragic can happen to them and it ends them. Other people will look at that tragedy and say, okay, God, this was a horrible thing that happened. But what's the one grain that I can take? Can I learn anything from this? And I think one of the good things that came about as a result of COVID is people are talking about the fact that they need help. They are reaching out. I know people who have steadfastly refused to get help their entire lives who are suddenly saying out loud, well, yeah, my therapist said, and I'm like, wow, that's so awesome.
And kind of, you know, what I think happened with COVID too is like there was like an opening of the system and so in the constellation world, when people are going through healing, sometimes they get really sick. Like right after a big movement, you get really sick. And I keep going back to this thought that that's what COVID was, because there is a shifting in consciousness. But you know what tells me more that there's a shifting in consciousness is that there's like this other, like there's this, you know, like movement globally that is like, we're gonna, you know, you're gonna own nothing and you're gonna like it. And so there's like this opposite force kind of like muddying the water of what the true shift in consciousness is, which is that we're systemically connected as this one consciousness rather than being individuals just kind of living our lives and going about it without any understanding of our relationship to each other, understanding that there is some intelligence that's inside the system. And so there's this opposing force that's saying like, you know, Carl Schwab or whatnot. Is it Carl Schwab? There's this like Darth Vader dude that's out in Europe that's like, you know, speaking about this new world, you know, reimagining of how the world's going to be. And it's like this, it's like the opposite of what what is actually happening, that there's this conscious awakening because you see it in culture. Everybody's starting to talk about unresolved trauma. Everybody's starting to talk about collective consciousness. Everybody's starting to talk about these things that, you know, the hippies and the crystals, and they've been talking about that for years, but it's starting to become part of our language. So it's like this fundamental shift, which is really interesting.
Yeah. And the merger of spirituality and science.
Yeah.
So exciting. Yeah. And, you know, I, as I said, I'm generally speaking an optimistic person. I've learned to recognize the importance of acknowledging dark because it's there.
Yeah.
It's part
of life.
The world is created in perfect balance and light couldn't exist if there wasn't dark. But what I find so fascinating now with each one of these experiences and this healing journey that I'm on, the coincidences or God incidences become more and more frequent.
Yeah.
And I would never become nonchalant to that happening, but I can recognize it now. So when I get on a plane and I sit down and start talking to the person next to me, and her husband is a psychologist, and all three of us are flying out to California, and she's the mother of three girls, and one of her daughters is a psychologist, and the husband is flying out to California to win an award for this trauma center he set up. He's a psychiatrist, sorry. He doesn't believe in medication. He doesn't believe in giving people medication who are traumatized. He believes in working on the root cause. And I'm like, of course. Like, that's so cool. It's so cool. I never talk to the person sitting next to me because I don't want to bother them.
Yeah.
I kind of test the waters. And if they put their headphones on, I'm like, I get it. Yeah, I'm a chatty person. I like to talk to people. Not everybody does, especially on a plane. But it just absolutely, it makes me feel humbled when that happens. Because it's like a, hey, pay attention. Pay attention. Plug in and pay attention.
So there's a really interesting, so you've heard of The Secret, right? Secret.
Yeah.
I think that in its current interpretation is bullshit, right? It's like, I don't think that you can be like, think your way to success, you know, like, and then you'll manifest, you'll like change the material of the world and like change the world in front of you, right? That you can't like be like, I want a Ferrari, I want a Ferrari, I want a Ferrari, and then like somebody just pulls up with a Ferrari. You know, I don't think that that's the case. But what I do think is this, is that the world, the reality is in a superposition, like in quantum physics, right? Anything is possible in that moment right in front of you. And what trauma does, it doesn't allow you to see the world of possibilities and connect to your intuition. So you could have been on that flight, and if you would have been in a different place in your life, you would have not talked to them or not seen the potential paths that could have happened or the potential realities that could have unfolded, right? And every single moment where we have these micro decisions that change the course of the ship, and suddenly 20 years later, the ship is in a completely different place, in a completely different reality that is that reality that you manifested, rather than being down the, you know, trauma path, right? So I think that in some capacity you can think your future, but it's like you think your future in these micro moments that change the course of your life to that place. Does that make sense?
Makes perfect sense. That, you put like, that beautifully. Yep, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think the importance of saying yes.
Thanks, Mom.
The importance of saying yes can never be underestimated.
Yeah.
You know, the whole notion of feel the fear and do it anyway.
Yeah,
it's working on your stuff. It's hard work.
Oh, it sucks.
But the alternative
is
so much worse, and people don't realize. And, you know, I've talked to people, and they're mired in so much pain.
Yeah.
And I just want to say,
work on your shit. Work on your shit. Work on your shit.
Because what lies on the other side is peace and healing.
Mm-hmm.
And you can heal.
And balance.
And balance. And you can heal it so that future generations, that's not part of your legacy.
Yeah.
Your legacy is going to be something different. It's not going to be perfect what you pass on, but it's going to look quite different than what you inherited.
But there's so many people that say that this is such a like prevalent thought. They're like, well, I had to go through it. It's like, yeah, you're being loyal to your system. Like it can be different. It can be completely different. They can go, your kids can have their own path without all the traumatic, you know, or like the karmatic load that you're bringing in from all the trauma of your family system. It's like, they don't have to necessarily go through that. They can like have an easy life. Not an easy life, but a life that's in flow, that you can choose to do hard things because you're in that state of flow, is a great place to be.
Yeah.
You know?
And to do it naturally.
Yeah.
Without...
With ease.
And without necessarily being medicated.
Because
the fact that, you know, off the coast of Florida right here, if you test the water, guess what you're going to find?
Yeah.
I mean...
Antidepressants in the ocean.
And I'm not saying that pharmaceutical solutions don't have a place, because they absolutely do. But I think that I think that big pharma and insurance are doing a huge injustice to our system. We're so focused on treating people instead of preventing illnesses, yeah. including preventing mental illnesses.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of tools that you can utilize that will help minimize the impact of whatever you're going through so yeah. that you don't reach a state where you're catatonic because you've gone through trauma.
So some of these, like some of the anti-anxiety medications are great for somebody that's going through a very intense phase.
Yeah, short term.
But short term, and they're very effective to get somebody off the ledge and that they can get into, traditional therapy or do some, new modality. They're very effective for that. But it's turned into like the short term is turned into a long term. It's like you're supposed to use some of these medications for like 4 weeks. And some people have been on them for 10 years, just turning that part off of their body, like turning that part off of their senses. They're just shutting, they're dimming the light on such an important aspect of who they are that is really an alarm system. Like anxiety is being grateful to anxiety shows you where to heal. Being grateful to depression says there's some stuff that you have to look at here that's hidden under all this crap that will make your life better on the other side. We're just like, oh, I'm going to turn that off. Take this pill and let's turn that thing off. Not to say that taking the pill to temporarily get you out of really dark places are an extremely effective and important tool. But man, long term, he's like, you got to look at this really ugly stuff.
I think what's happening in the field of plant-based medicine is just so incredibly exciting, and I think that's the future. That's why it's so important to protect the Amazon.
Yeah.
It's really exciting.
And you mean like ayahuasca?
Yes.
Ayahuasca. Yes. Yeah.
Yep, ayahuasca.
Yeah. I mean, how do you square that? Like, how do you come to terms with that? Because Constellations is already like, people are what? Like, what? I was like, I thought you guys were in a cult when you guys first talked to me about Constellations. I was like, oh, my mom and my sister are in a cult now, so they're crazy people, and they're going to go to drink the Kool-Aid in New Guinea or whatever. And, then I saw Constellations, I'm like, wow, this is a thing. Then I had to technically answer the question, which I did. See Rupert Sheldrake, see, morphic resonance, see quantum entanglement, see all those things. That's kind of like the technical side of it. But how do you, like, so Constellations is a step far, like way out of people's comfort zones. How do you get to the place of, like, doing ayahuasca? Like, how do you get to that place?
So the way that I look at Constellations and ayahuasca, Constellation helps put in alignment the hardware.
Okay.
And ayahuasca helps put in alignment the software.
Wow.
So you marry the two, and it's the perfect combination for a whole and healed person.
That's a very good way of putting it.
The reason that I was attracted to ayahuasca was because you and your sister, you brought it to me, and I saw changes taking place. I saw a peace, an insight that I was attracted to, and I wanted to learn more about it. Ayahuasca, I don't know if you want to explain a little bit. I don't know. I mean, I know that the Indians in Peru have been for 1,000 years mixing the bark of the tree with something else and diluting it down.
There's a whole theory. First, there's a theory. I think it's like Dennis McKenna, the stoned ape theory, that says that how lower primates, like how monkeys and stuff, became, their brains grew to humans, was through psychedelic experiences. It's the whole theory. And then there's another theory. There's a guy named Graham Hancock that was saying that, I'm paraphrasing this, and I'm just kind of loosely basing it, so don't take it to the bank. But there's this other theory that says that potentially all religious experiences are experiences that come from psychedelics. That, the interpretation of the burning bush, the interpretation of the, many of the stories of the Bible are these profound insights that come from the realm of, you know, psychedelics. So it's like, and after going through those experiences, you're like, oh, well, that can make sense. You know, like that's a thing. So, but, you know, people have been taking this medicine for many, many years, and it is medicine. It's not a fun thing to do. It's a therapeutic process. It's not a, you know, it's not a, like, oh, I'm going to go party and do this. Like, I would prefer to do a millionth. I'd prefer to get a root canal than to do that.
There's zero chance you're going to become an addict.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, if you're addicted to that, like, man, you're a glutton for punishment. But it's extraordinarily useful in kind of uncovering like a shock to the system, kind of, or like a restructuring of the system that really brings out a completely different perspective. If Constellation does that for the here and now, which is the kind of the known realm, it does it for the unknown realm, which is really interesting to see. It's like people lose fear of death, and, you know, they lose fear of, and they get to know an entity of, that some people call God. They get to know, go to the kind of, you know, vast unknown of the universe or consciousness. And it's really powerful used correctly. You know, some people, you know, kind of make it cool, and that's not the way to me, that doesn't seem like a good use of the tool. But if used appropriately, it's very powerful.
So for me, the example that I go back to is, I knew through constellation work the importance of honoring my mother and my father. Mm. And through traditional therapy, I've done a lot of work around my relationship with both of my parents. And I thought that I was at peace with my mother until I did an ayahuasca ceremony. I've done a few now. My last ayahuasca ceremony, I just had this opportunity to see my mother in all of her glory, the magnificent woman that she was, and to honor her. And I just, and I, like, I have this connection ever since that ceremony. I have this, I'm profoundly in love with my mother, to the point where now every morning when I get up, there's a picture of her I have on my area where I do prayers and meditations, and I light a candle in honor of my mother. It's just, and now, you know, when you were going back full circle to the meditation we started with at the beginning, feeling her over my shoulder, I just feel love. I feel love and connection to her, where in the past, my mom loved me. She loved all three of us, but she learned when she was 9 years old and her brother died instantly in a car crash that you can only extend love to people outside of your immediate circle because they'll be taken from you. Mm. I knew that intellectually, but I felt loved. A psychologist once told me, it doesn't matter where you get your feeling of love from, as long as you feel it from one person, you're going to survive. I was loved by my sister Sue. My unconditional love my entire life from my sister Sue and my sister Belinda. Those were the people that loved me. I knew my parents loved me because, you know, they kind of had to because I was their kid. But now,
legally required to,
I feel a deep and profound love from my mother. And I don't think that if I had not done ayahuasca, I don't think that I would feel that peace. And most importantly, that support. It makes me be a better human. It makes me be a more present mother.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Than if I didn't have that.
So there's this, I've been kind of wrestling around with this concept. You know, it's like I think there's two of us. There's a physical us, and then there's like a spiritual us. And, or, you know, some people call it like the meta, you know, like the meta mother, right? So it's like your mother and I feel this, you know, and in some people have the blessing to have both that are aligned. Like the spiritual side and the physical side are aligned, but some people don't. And I think that you know, when we do that meditation, the meditation, you know, for people that haven't listened to the meditation is like you close your eyes, take these deep breaths, and you imagine your mother behind your left shoulder and your father behind your right shoulder. And then your grandparents behind them and their great-grandparents behind them and so on until, you know, you see all your ancestors. And what you're really connecting to is like the meta-mother, right? The meta-father, the spiritual of those people, the spiritual representations in your ancestry of who those people are. And those people are perfect and whole and complete and not the embodied pain that they are in this realm. And so like if you're able to align those two people, I think that's what healing is that you align the spiritual and the physical to say the physical, these things happened or weren't available or whatever that looks like, but the spiritual is whole and I'm deeply connected with that. Even if you didn't know the person, even if they were abusive, if there, you know, if there was sexual abuse, if there was anything, even any of those things, you can still connect with the meta spirit of that. Does that make sense?
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
So profound. And it's so exciting. It's so exciting that there's a path.
Yeah.
There's a way forward. That we're not just born into the world and then we consume a bunch of stuff and we suffer a lot and then we die.
Yeah.
Oh, what a sad existence. Wow.
Yeah, and even people that were adopted, you can go to everybody has a mother and father.
Yeah.
Biological. Like everybody has a
You're on Earth through something.
It could have been the worst scenarios, but you're still here for something. And there, you can honor that connection at least. And like, one thing that's happened to me a lot is like I'm starting to look at religion from like tradition, not from, you know, not with all the judgment, you know, like there's a lot of judgment in religion. People look at religion like, Bert Hellinger, the gentleman that started Family Constellations, somebody was saying at a workshop, he was saying, are you religious? And she said, no, I'm spiritual. And he said, oh, worse. Because there's this implicit judgment in religion, right? It's like, you're judging tradition. And I think religion, for whatever reason, is just a momentum of stories and truths that we've had over a long period of time. And that story and those truths have stuff in it, right? That may be accurate and there's influence and all those things, right? But it does have these profound truths in it. So you take the religious piece, you take the constellation piece, you take the ayahuasca piece, you take the spiritual psychedelic piece, you take all these things together and they all have like a connecting narrative about honoring your ancestry, about connecting with your lineage, about, you know, being at peace and in balance, about right-sizing things, about discovering the trauma, about sacrifice, and going through, you know, the story of Christ is a story of sacrifice. It's like, you know, Father, why have you forsaken me? Is this, you know, trauma load, right? It's like you can see it from that narrative. And like there's the story of Cain and Abel is the story of the victim and the perpetrator. And it's like that story and that narrative of the victim and the perpetrator is a narrative that we have in all of our society. And we all have that battle within. So it's like, how can you deny the incredible insight that religion has? And some people judge it from that perspective. So I think there's like this grand connecting conversation that is really interesting that we're like just now starting to explore.
Yeah. And I personally am thrilled to hear that you've included the religion piece because that's you came full circle on that.
Yeah. That was tough.
But I honor the fact that you didn't just blindly accept. It means so much more to you because you went down that path of exploration.
Yeah.
And I really respect that.
Yeah, that was tough. It's been full circle. And, you know, I know people have a lot of issue with them, but I do. Jordan Peterson really helped me with that. Like, I know some people are like, but I don't, like, I think there's profound insight in what he says.
Take what works and leave the rest.
Yeah, exactly.
Nobody's perfect.
Nobody's perfect, right? But I think there's some really profound things that talks about. Everybody's all the above. You know, everybody's, you know, D, all the above. You're even the worst people in history were all the above, right?
Yeah.
Like you, there's everybody has some good, you know? And yeah. some people have profound pain and they create, you know, catastrophic scenarios. But, you know, if we judge others, it's how harshly we judge ourselves.
That's right. I read that in the Bible.
Yeah, right? I mean, exactly. Like, you talk about, you know, people talk about, I was having this conversation, so I was at the beach and I do these, you know, I do the guided meditations on the beach. And these guys came up to me and we were talking about religion. And he was like, you know, it says in the Bible we can judge other Christians. I'm like, that doesn't seem like a good idea, man. Judgment is between God and that person. We're no one to judge. We're no one to judge because judge entangles us to the person, right? We can say, you know, like, and even in society, I think our legal system, this is a big, bold statement, but I think our legal system is incorrect in that capacity, that we have judges that you know, castigate people. I think it should be, you know, like, I'm almost thinking that there should be arbiters that are saying, like, more referees that are saying, hey, you know, I've been assigned to, this is what the agreements of our society is, and you've broken that agreement, and if you break that agreement, there's consequences, right? Because I think judgment has such a, like a moral implication to it that we, the arbiter might be a better structure. Mm-hmm. Saying we all agreed as a society that you have to drive 55 miles an hour and you were going 75. You've broken that agreement and we've all agreed that if somebody breaks that agreement, that these are the consequences that you do. You take your license away, whatever that is, right? I think just judgment has so much entanglement. And then forgiveness has the same thing. People talk about forgiveness. Like, we're no one to forgive. Forgiveness is between the person and their creator or aliens or, you know, the virtual reality or, you know, the simulation or whatever that is, because forgiveness also entangles us to people, because first we have to judge. You said, you've wronged me, and then I have the power to absolve you of that wrongdoing. It's like, there's so many in our language, in our culture, there's so many just in, like, structures that are very old that entangle us to everything.
Yeah. And I think people confuse having an opinion and judging. And you absolutely have to have an opinion. It's what keeps us safe.
Yes.
You know, I think that this man is dangerous, is my opinion. And I'm going to stay away from this man. Yeah. It becomes judgment when I say, I think this man is dangerous and I think I'm better than he is.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's something that people confuse. It absolutely is critical to have opinions. You don't always have to share them with people.
Yeah, but opinions have flexibility, you know?
In the perfect world.
In a perfect world, opinions have flexibility. Judgments are rigid and entangle you to the person. I think that's such a profound...
Yeah, that is
profound. So that was Alberto saying that, right? That was the first facilitator that we came across. And I was so blown away by that statement. There's been two statements in the constellation world that have blown my mind. That, like, we're no one to forgive. First, we're no one to forgive. And the other one is assumption of responsibility. What does it mean to assume responsibility? It's like, oh, like, really think of assumption of responsibility. Like, and I've been accused of going overboard with assumption of responsibility. I think everything's my fault, you know, like in some way. It's like,
that's but something to look into.
Oh, yeah. Shit. But like, I think the right sizing of that is important for me. But like, I think responsibility for me has shifted a little bit from, and Michelle talks about this, another dear friend and facilitator, is like, responsibility is the ability to respond, because trauma keeps you frozen in the pattern.
That's good.
Right?
Yeah. Well, and with children, you know, boy, I think the very definition of maturity is when people, maybe 60-year-old people, when they learn to assume responsibility for the choices that they've made.
Yeah.
Like, your life is an accumulation of the choices you've made.
Yeah.
Period. That defines maturity.
Yeah.
I mean, stuff happens to us, of course, that we have no control over, but how do we choose to respond to what's happened to us?
Yeah.
That's what we have control over.
Yeah. So there's a big thing that I want to talk to you about. Tell me about the last leg of your career as a diplomat. What was that like?
Oh, so as I mentioned, I was
talking about victims and perpetrators.
Yes, I was assigned to Warsaw, Poland. You have mandatory retirement when you turn 65, and I turned 65. I was supposed to have left Warsaw in March of 2022, and they extended me administratively, so I ended up, my last date in Warsaw was July 30th. And on February 24th, and I had my plan. I had all the places in Poland that we hadn't yet visited that we were going to visit, and I was going to, you know, just really enjoy this last chapter of my career.
Were you thinking like, oh, you know, I'm at the last leg. I'm you know, short on retirement. I'm just going to coast into
this. No, I never thought that. Not for a minute. Have you met me? but I knew what it was going to look like.
Yeah.
I knew in my mind what it was going to look like. And then February 24th happened, and I remember sitting on the couch in my living room, and I was crying because I never thought that I would see a war next door in my lifetime, never. And saying to God, because I was tired. I was tired. I'm a really hard worker, and I was tired. And I worked really, really hard in Poland. And I was ready to pull up roots and come back and reconnect with my family and my grandkids and my friends. And so February 24th takes place. I'm on the couch realizing what's happening, and I start crying.
So for people that don't have the full context, what happened February 24th?
The invasion. Russia invaded Ukraine once again. And so I'm crying and I'm talking to God and I'm saying, God, I don't think that I can do this, because I knew once it started, I knew, because I've been through traumatic scenarios happening before in Venezuela with flooding. I was in Mexico and there was a massive earthquake. I know what happens in these scenarios. And I'd been in the embassy structure for 24 years, so I knew immediately what was going to happen within what's called the country team of the embassy, which is the ambassador at the helm. The ambassador is the direct connection to the president of the United States. He speaks for the president of the United States. I knew that everyone on that country team was going to have their responsibility. So the military attaché, pretty obvious what they're going to be doing.
Yeah.
The public affairs people, pretty obviously what they're going to be doing with messaging and the U.S. position. And so we all knew what was going to take place. And I knew what our agency, the small team that I led, we were going to be responsible for connecting companies and people who wanted to make donations of humanitarian aid, whether it was to the refugees coming into Poland or directly to Ukraine. I knew instantly that that was going to be our role. Without even ever gone into the embassy for our first big sit down, you guys are going to be doing this, I'll do this, I knew it. And
so just in context, why is Poland, positionally, what is Poland in that strategic kind of play in that theater? What is Poland?
So if you look at a map, and I highly encourage you all to do that, look at the map and look at where Poland sits geographically. Poland is a member of the NATO. They are one of our strongest allies in the world. And this was true even before Russia invaded Ukraine. So I'll get into that in a little bit. But so I'm sitting on the couch with the realization of what is about to take place. And I'm crying and I'm talking to God. And I'm saying, God, I don't think I can do this. And God's response was, it wasn't a question. Everything in my life led me to be in that position in time, to be doing exactly what I was doing. And I'm not saying that I was irreplaceable. I'm not saying that all of this incredible stuff would have happened if I hadn't been in that position. But I knew that I was going to be facilitating some things. And I needed to put on my big girl pants and step into that leadership role and get my team to refocus everything that they've been doing, some of them for 30 years, 30 plus years, and learn how to ensure that the much needed supplies and donations got to their intended destination. And we did that every single day for weeks on end.
So the first kind of wave was, holy crap, this just happened. And the whole world's response is, how can we help?
Yes.
And there wasn't infrastructure. There wasn't country team. There wasn't the military. There wasn't the UN. There was no one.
So there was certainly, yes, there parts of that are true. There's certain military, the military infrastructure was incredible. But
I mean, at the really beginning, it was like, who do we call?
Right. I thought when there was, you know, a natural disaster or war broke out, or there was, you know, I thought that there was just going to be this huge team of people that showed up from all these international relief organizations. But, and certainly there were some people on the ground that played absolutely critical roles that saved many, 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 many lives. But it takes time to mobilize the Red Cross, the United States, all of these organizations, global organizations. It takes time. What resource? You don't want to just have thousands of people show up with, you know. And I'll tell you that there was one instance early on of a medical donation that a company sent, you know, just an incredible, incredible, generous gift of $3 million of much needed medicine. There was no label on it. It was put on a plane that arrived and just, it went to waste. It needed to be refrigerated. It went to waste. So that was new information to me, because the team, you know, we're like, everybody's looking around going, well, who's going to do this? And the embassy in the Ukrainian embassy in Poland was a skeletal staff. I mean, they didn't, you know, they had no idea. So, it was the honor of a lifetime to be in that role. And I could talk about this for a long time, but I won't. To see, I think the thing that touched me the most out of all the things that I saw was the way that the Polish people opened their doors, their hearts, their homes to 4 million Ukrainian women and children. Because 95% of the women streaming across the border, of the people streaming across the border, were women and children, because from 16 to 60, men weren't allowed because they needed them to fight the war. Yeah. And there's, if you're interested, Poland's history is just absolutely fascinating. The history between Ukraine and Poland, there was bad blood, and it disappeared. Overnight, it disappeared. And certainly relief shelters were set up, but what Poles did was invite people into their homes, strangers, for weeks on end. I didn't know anybody that wasn't in some way helping the Ukrainian refugees. I didn't know a single person, whether they had them living with them, whether they were sponsoring them to live in a hotel down the street, whether they were doing food drives, you know, clothing, whatever. People just changed overnight. And Warsaw, the city that I lived in, within days, all of a sudden you would see these people who kind of looked like Poles, but they were Ukrainian women and children, and they would be carrying their suitcases behind them. And you could see from the time they first arrived until they had started becoming assimilated into the culture, you would see these people, these women, who were just and the children who were just shell-shocked because what they saw, and as the war grew on, what they lived was just undescribable. It was just undescribable in this day and age that this is taking place, and it's taking place right next to Poland. And in the early stages, you know, we would read the news and there would be some, oh, this isn't really, and why is the U? And I'm like, you have no idea what you're talking about. Like, read other news sources, because the news that you're reading could not, I've seen it with my own eyes. This is the truth. And I was so, I mean, the outpouring of generosity from companies all over the world was incredible, but the outpouring from U.S. companies and U.S. individuals was just, it leaves me speechless what people were willing to do. It's just, I saw the face of evil. I was once at a conference in Romania, and I saw the president of Russia walk down the hall, and now I know what oozed from him is trauma. What I thought at the time it was evil, I now know it was trauma. And yeah. I've also seen the goodness of people. I believe that people are good. They are inherently good. Some of them have had a lot of trauma layered on top of that goodness, yeah. But God created us, and we are good. We are inherently good people.
Isn't there a story that, I don't know if it's true, obviously, you know, he's an agent of, you know, he's a product of his environment, obviously. But you and I talked about this during this time, that, you know, there's a story that he tells, that President Putin tells, that his, you know, that he was walking, that his father was on leave or something from the war, the World War II. And Russia was just threw 25 million Russians at the Nazis, basically. And that he saw a pair of shoes, and then he pulls his mother. You know, it was a pile of bodies, and he sees this pair of shoes that he recognizes, and pulls his mother's body from a pile of bodies. Then she's still alive. He realizes that she's still alive, and he nurses her back to life, and then that's. From what I don't know if he'd already been born or he had not been born. But, and some people say it's not true, right?
Yeah that's heard that too.
Right.
Yeah.
Some people say it's not true and that's okay, you know, it's okay, whatever. Like, that's fine, right? But the narrative exists. And I think in that story, there's a profound truth and there's profound insight in that story. Is that out of the rubble, a pile of bodies, then if you translate that, and I'm not trying to, you know, psychologically, you know, cross-examine this guy, but if you look at that story, and if that story resonates, and that if that's a narrative, maybe that's a narrative in his orbit, it really talks about the trauma of disaster of what that was. Really puts things into context and saying, if you're willing to nurse out of the rubbles of destruction, your mother, the motherland, your country, whatever that is, you're willing to do whatever it takes, including becoming a perpetrator in somebody else's story. So it's like, I think there's these narratives that really put into context who we are and can really provide insight into the power of what stories and patterns are in our family or in our systems and our larger systems, and how we may be the victim in our story, but then the perpetrator in somebody else's.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. Isn't that a profound truth that's difficult for many people to accept? We are both.
We are both. Yeah. Well, I think we're going to leave it right there.
I just have to take a moment. I'm going to try really hard not to cry. Just tell you how incredibly proud I am of you. And wow, to see the healing that has taken place in you and your sister and your spouses and your families and your orbit, the people who, so many people that surround you. It is profoundly moving. And just as I knew when I was sitting at that couch that everything in my life had brought me, professionally speaking, had brought me to that place in time. Everything in my life, personally speaking, has brought me to this place in time to be your mother and see the work that you and your sister have done, the profound ways that you are healing yourself and healing the world. I couldn't be more proud of you.
Thank you. Love you.
Love you too.